Movie theaters are modern-day pulpits. Real-world theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture and to remind viewers that entertainment is not mindless.
Welcome to Real World Theology, episode 109. On this episode, we're joined by fan favorite and executive pastor at Church of the Redeemer here in Greensboro, Elijah Lovejoy. Rounding out our panel is also friend of the show and first-time guest, Hunter Van Wagenen. So listen up. We've got a really great show for you because we talk hell or high water and justice versus law.
But yeah, sure, this one did sneak up on me. But it snuck up on me in two ways. So, Hell or High Water not only was something I didn't even have on the schedule. When I sent out, hey, what are y'all interested in? Who wants to do this one? Who wants to do this one? And who's even in the ballpark for this? Hell or High Water wasn't even on the radar. Mm-hmm. I can't say that enough. It wasn't on the radar. It wasn't even a movie that I'd heard of. Mm-hmm. Which is weird, because it's not like it doesn't have good people behind it. The writer wrote Sicario. Mm-hmm. You know, the director directed one of a movie that I really enjoyed. It was either last year or the year before, Start Up.
The editor was the editor for Brooklyn.
There you go. So it's got people who've done great stuff, and then it has Captain Kirk in it, and a more serious turn. Which actually, yeah, he's kind of done a couple of those things. I think it was Z for Zachariah or something recently. Mm-hmm. Never got to see it, but it's more of those.
You haven't seen that.
I didn't miss a whole lot. Oh man, I was hoping it was gonna be I didn't think it was gonna be good. I just thought it would be better than I thought it could be. So no, it got vetoed. But so then all of a sudden people are the people in my larger critic, reviewing circle sort of being like, savvy. This movie. And I'm like, don't tell me that, because 2016 for me has been a disappointment.
Yeah. I'm going to make news tonight about this movie.
So okay,
I'm raring to go.
You're raring to go.
Headlines.
Yeah, I'm going to make headlines.
New York Times tomorrow.
Yeah, this is great because it snuck up on me because I didn't know about it, but then it snuck up on me because I enjoyed it so much, and I think there is so much worth talking about in the film, mm-hmm, that I was like, well, I need mm-hmm to do the podcast on this. And then I was like, oh gosh, I need to do the podcast on this right now.
Yeah.
To get it in by a date, and then fortunately, Hunter and Elijah, you guys were free. So
serendipitous.
Yeah. Serendipitous. Absolutely. So especially because Elijah, fan favorite Elijah Lovejoy, Elijah Lovejoy, has not been on the podcast for a while. He's been too busy doing his job.
Well, you know what I would say? I would say this movie brought me out of retirement.
Oh man,
I'm coming out of retirement. Just for this movie.
I think it'd be more appropriate if this was the last movie that you did, the day before you were going to retire.
Yeah, you know? I'm like Michael Jordan. I'm gonna retire, come back.
You went and played baseball podcast, yes, and now you're coming back.
That's right. I was trying to pick up golf podcasting.
Oh man, but like I said, so when I thought about the cast in general, there wasn't, like I said, Chris Pine, Ben Foster, who I had seen in things. He was actually in Warcraft, a movie that I enjoy that probably no one else did, and for understandable reasons. But he really, he was an actor that I recognized, but from here on out, I will be looking for because of this film. So I guess the first thing is, you guys wouldn't be here if there wasn't something, either a blood debt or blood oath to me that you owe, or there was something about the film. So hopefully, and because I know Elijah's more eager, I'm going to make him wait. So, Hunter, just what did you like about this film? Because I'm assuming that you liked this film.
I did. I thought probably what stood out to me the most was the characters. I thought the three actors, Jeff Bridges, Ben Foster, Chris Pine, were all just really good performances. They were fairly subtle. I mean, I thought just the characterization of the old, about to retire Texas Ranger, who's super racist and you know, going to be bored out of his mind in retirement. I just thought that was, you know, even though it's, not, I wouldn't say a stock character, it's mm-hmm. it's fairly a commonly used, retirement is commonly used
yeah.
In movies. But I just thought he knocked it out of the park. I mean, just his voice, like mm-hmm. his whatever he was doing with his jaw, where you barely understand him. I mean, it just worked so well.
Well, I know a lot of people mentioned that all of these, or at least the three main characters, all bordered on, like, not just stereotypes, but like characters of people we would think from West Texas, but they all stop right before they go too far to be made fun of,
yeah.
and like push it to the extreme while still be taken serious. And that's at least that's how I felt about Bridges' character.
Yeah, I mean, I've never really spent much time in Texas. Have not been to West Texas at all. I've known lots of Texans. So my context is basically the same as, you know, what seeing Mad Max and thinking about Australia. You know? It's like, well, I guess it's accurate, but.
Well, so I Elijah, open up the floodgates. What did you like about this film? Well, and I'll give you another one too, right, and that you right. can come back to. How does it compare to other films you've seen in 2016?
That's what I'm going to say. So it's got to be at least 6 months since I've been on the podcast, mm-hmm. just because of busyness and schedules. But as you know, this weekend I came to you and I said, Mikey, I'm willing to clear my schedule to do this podcast, which you hadn't planned on doing, but it's happened and we're here. And like I said, I consider this movie to be worth coming out of retirement for if I was in retirement in any sense in the last 6 months. So here's what I'm going to say about this movie. After having watched it and thought about it over and over and over again, I now think this is the best movie of the year, hands mm-hmm. down, easily.
Hands down.
And here's why. I'll tell you why.
Well, can I ask you one thing before that?
Sure.
Because I want to know why.
Yeah, yeah.
But comparatively, what would you have said the best movie of the year was before this movie?
I'd have to look at a list of what I've seen this year so far, so it's hard for me to say, but I'm speaking primarily in terms of memorability. Like, mm-hmm. I can't remember a lot of other movies yeah. I've seen this mm-hmm. year, and I see about a movie a week mm-hmm. or every other week at a minimum.
Mm-hmm.
So I see easily 3 to 4 movies a month, and I can't remember
most of them.
But
I think that's at most people's experience in 2016.
But I think I'm going to remember this movie for a long time and be telling people about it.
Okay.
So what, and I'm going to make my case to you because I know I saw your post on Facebook that you don't think it's the best movie. So I'm going to try to persuade you that.
Wait, but did I say it was the best movie?
You said, I don't think it's the best movie of the year, but it was good.
Is what you said. I mean.
So I'll just tease it. I'm not going to spill all the beans now, but I'll tease it. So what I love so much about this movie is it felt to me like the perfect balance of very interesting, very entertaining character development
mm-hmm.
and very profound, very deep, multi-layered, almost parable-like storytelling. Mm-hmm. And so you can watch it just as, wow, those were really good characters. As one reviewer put it, a good movie has 3 memorable scenes in it, and this one had like 10 memorable scenes mm-hmm. in it. So,
and no bad scenes.
And no bad mm-hmm. scenes. So just in terms of the acting and the storytelling on an individual character level, very engaging. But what started convincing me that I think this is the best movie of the year is a lot of the symbolism mm-hmm. and parallelism and moral dilemma-ism, if I can make up a term, that it raised the more I thought about it.
So what I would follow that up with is, do you think that is because all this is in your wheelhouse, like specifically it's speaking to you, or do you think the things that this movie does well should generally like be caught by everyone? And most people objectionably can be like, oh wow, that really is doing a lot.
I think once I say some of the parallelism and, mm-hmm. and some of the stuff that I think it's going to be obvious. And so I don't think it's just me. I mean, I'm a pastor, so I'm trained to pay attention to
yeah.
big themes, spiritual mm-hmm. dilemmas, if you will. And so I think, and even biblical symbolism, which I think there's a lot of biblical mm-hmm. symbolism in this mm-hmm. movie. So I think maybe that gives me a little bit of an advantage in seeing some of it. But I think once I kind of lay it out, I think it'll be obvious to anybody whether they're spiritually interested or not.
Only because you're a gifted teacher and preacher.
No, because it's such a good movie. It's because it's such a good material.
I just wanted to make sure your message was consistent.
Yes. I'm staying by my guns. No pun intended.
No, that's good.
Just so, like a Texan.
So before we tear into that, Elijah, so I want to go back to you, Hunter. I know that you were being modest, I think, right before the show and saying that you're not, you're a moderate movie guy, but I think you're a pretty solid movie guy. I've actually personally gone to see movies with you. A lot of the times that's I've true. Gone to see movies with, this year. So I know that you've seen a good deal. So Hell or High Water, I don't need a star rating. I don't need it's number one, number two, where is it? Where is it compared to your other 2016 films that you've seen?
It didn't have Captain America in it.
That's so true.
You know,
Strike One. Captain Kirk.
Captain Kirk was in it, so you know, there's that. But I think, as far as giving me a lot to chew on,
mm-hmm.
it probably is number one. I don't know if I would say it was necessarily the most entertaining, the most exciting, the most, the wow factor was not there, but it didn't need to be. I mean, not what the movie was about. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a blockbuster. It was, it's funny. There was a trailer for Magnificent Seven before, and I leaned over and said to you, that didn't look like a Western to me. That looked like
not a Western.
This movie felt like a Western, just in its pacing and its, the sort of those dialogue scenes between sort of sometimes random characters that weren't even about anything necessarily, but they said so much at the same time.
Yeah, it was almost, it was like Seinfeld-esque where it's about nothing, but it really is about everything.
Yeah.
I want you to drill down in that a little bit more, because this movie has been described as like a modern Western.
Yeah.
You know, a Western set in what it would look like. But, it's certainly something I haven't seen very often, but because it's more than a Western, I think.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But it's not quite like just a crime thriller. So, if you had to kind of, describe this to somebody, someone's like, Hunter, should I go see Hell or High Water? I heard it was just a crime movie. And you're like, no, it's...
the way I described it to my fiance was it has great characters, but it explores issues of the economy. It explores issues of human nature, I would say. Mm-hmm. It explores that sort of, I think you mentioned at the beginning, law, justice,
mm-hmm.
Those sorts of issues. And so it's like a Western. It has a lot of philosophy to it, especially explored in those dialogues between mm-hmm. characters. So,
but just be like, it's good, go see it.
Yeah, essentially. That's the best answer I can really give you.
What kind of movie is it? It's a good movie.
Yeah.
I went into work today, and because all of my Letterboxd stuff posts to Facebook, my coworker kind of leans over and goes, "So, Fizz, I'd say go see Hell or High Water. Don't see Jason Bourne." I was like, "Yeah, that about sums up." not that anyone can't enjoy Jason Bourne, but based on my Letterboxd reviews, obviously that was the thing that I was putting across.
Yeah.
So Elijah, kind of same thing. Like, where does this movie fit as far as genre?
That's part of the beauty of the movie, right? So a good movie kind of scrambles genres or mm-hmm. mashes them up, if you will, and almost makes a genre of its own. So mm-hmm. I think, part of why superhero movies are getting old is because they're so cookie cutter now. Like, take hero, bring in alien, have hero beat up alien, and have everybody smiling or holding their girlfriend at the end of the movie. You're like, that's kind of oversimplistic, but
no, that's good, because that explains why people like Winter Soldier so much, because it's really like a spy thriller movie. Mm-hmm. Less than it is actual superhero movie.
Brings in another genre.
Yeah.
Right, but at the end of the day, superhero movies are just, they're tweaking the genre, but they're all kind of playing with the same the same parts. There's this exceptional ability, physical ability that's going to somehow save the day, and there's going to, you have to create the internal friction and the psychological drama in the team, and then that's all going to get worse. I mean, it's kind of predictable.
I'm sorry, he's just describing Mission Impossible.
and a lot of the Avengers stuff, I think. I mean, they got to turn the problem. But anyway, going back to this movie, I don't want to step on all the fans' toes, but...
Are you saying you don't like Avengers?
But what's unique about this movie is, like, it's a dilemma. Like, where do you put this in? Mm-hmm. And I think where this movie excels is, I would put it this way. Everybody in the movie agrees there's a problem, except for maybe a few bankers. But everybody agrees. Everybody agrees there's a problem. The people in the restaurant agree there's a problem. Mm-hmm. The graffiti on the wall agrees there's a problem. Even the Texas Rangers agree there's a problem. And these robbers agree there's a problem. So there's this kind of universal acknowledgement that there's a moral dilemma that the characters are facing, but what the movie does well is it amplifies the moral dilemma beyond just the two brothers who are robbing banks, and it's kind of saying the country's got a problem, and more than that, like, the heart of Red America has a problem. And if Red America has a problem, then by golly, there's a problem, yeah. Right? So just put the problem in the heart of West Texas, and, like, you've kind of gone for, if that kind of Republican voting block of the country feels like something's unjust, then it kind of, everybody else is probably going to feel the same way, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think it takes that idea that there's a problem, and then it toys with and teases out, like, what do you do about the problem? And it uses this stark, kind of off-the-wall, weird example of two brothers that are playing out kind of the perfect bank robbery as one stab at solving, quote, the problem. And so I think that's where the movie excels, is imposing the moral dilemma that we face essentially in our culture and society today. And saying, what do you do with this? And do you agree there's a problem? And how far would you go in solving the problem? So I actually see the movie more as parabolic, moral philosophy, moral dilemma, almost Coen brothers like, and they pose morality tale stuff, almost more of that. And the Western and the action and the comedy, in a lot of ways, is all the vehicle that takes you into the heart of this moral dilemma that I think they're playing with in terms of our culture today.
Yeah. So I want to make sure that I'm clear that some of the things I want to talk about next will take us into spoilers. So if this, for some reason, the first time you've ever listened to this show, one, thank you for listening to Real World Theology. Two, we're going to spoil everything about this movie so we can talk thematically about it. In that, I also wanted to kind of give like a general overview, because I realize we're talking about the film, but we haven't talked about what happens in the film. And, you have these two brothers, played by Chris Pine and Ben Foster, Tanner and Toby. Tanner, Ben Foster's character, obviously the one who's used to being in trouble, used to robbing banks. Chris Pine, the straight and narrow. Both of these guys have their way of looking at the world and the way that they have chosen to go about being in the world. And both have not found happiness. They've not found prosperity. They've not found joy, really, it seems like, in any real way. So they have gotten, Tanner's out of jail. They've gotten together. They've decided to rob some banks to pay off the land that they are inheriting. So, because oil was found on this land, and they don't want the bank to take it over, because the bank has done some mischievous things and a couple other unsaid things in a place in the country that's down on its luck. So the bank hasn't really been helping out. So by its own craftiness, the bank is about to take over this land. So they've devised this scheme to do this thing. And in the meantime, we have Jeff Bridges and his partner, Alberto, who is a Native American. And they are, Jeff Bridges' character, Marcus, about, one day from retirement.
Yeah.
Classic story, like Hunter pointed out. You know, we've seen this in every buddy cop film. And he's determined to get these bank robbers to solve this case before he retires. And this obviously is ultimately going to lead to some kind of confrontation.
Yeah.
And so that's where we find all the stuff. You know, it's all set against this backdrop of West Texas being super poor. We get lots of long shots of just desolate, empty, you know, fast cash, you know, graffiti, like Elijah mentioned, just run down abandoned towns. And this is the backdrop, you know, problematic middle America.
Yeah. I think one important detail is that the bank tricked their mother. It was their mother that the bank was sort of conniving against to put her in a position where they would
get the land. Yeah.
And yeah, they're brothers, they love their mom. They have this common
that's a really good point, because well, I can say that's a different brother dynamic that we could talk about, how people see the world, because Toby obviously admits and through his actions cared for his mother.
Right.
Tanner, who felt abandoned, obviously was asking questions because he still did care about his mom, but ultimately said, you know, like, F her.
Yeah.
She didn't care about me anyway. But, you know, is more of a
still
defense
like a,
mechanism.
Yeah, you did this against my family, so therefore revenge.
And I think it's important to say that so I'm gonna let one of the teasers out of the bag. Okay. So I think part of the parallelism of this movie is that you actually have two sets of brothers, and they're both getting kind of equal face time and equal character development, and so you're being invited into two worlds simultaneously: the Tanner Toby world, the two brothers that are robbing the banks, and then the Marcus Alberto world, the two brothers that are trying to catch the robbers. And so I think part of what's important to say is that one of the brothers in those two sets is driving the train, so to speak, in terms of motivation, ideation. And so Tanner is helping Toby carry out his scheme of paying off the bank's reverse mortgage to his mom. And so in a lot of ways, though Tanner is a very compelling character, he's kind of along for the ride on Toby's plan. And I think the same thing could be said about Alberto being along for the ride on Marcus's plan. So so I think that the two brothers dynamic, even how they fight, even how they joke, even how they die, which I'll get to that in a second, is paralleled throughout the whole movie.
Yeah.
And so you're being invited to love two brothers, but you're also being invited to wrestle with the ultimate clash that's going to come between these two sets of brothers that have different goals, though they agree on, interestingly, some of the same problems.
Well, no, see, that's what's interesting to me, and it's one of the things that I think we talked about when we were walking out of the movie, just the interesting, like, obviously one's related by blood, and the other one is related by duty, you know? You have two situations where neither probably really picked their brother, which is, you know, one of the things about brotherhood. You typically can't pick who your brother is.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, you know, you pick your friends, but your family is chosen for you. You know, one of those things. And so you have two lawmen who probably signed up for similar reasons on the same mission, and seeing how they have to get along. And then how brothers who, like I said at the beginning, they went on very opposite ways. Mm-hmm. Tanner obviously had his own way of doing whatever felt right to him at the time, not caring about how it really affected other people, and it didn't work out for him. And Toby, you know, Chris Pine's character, seemed, you know, he stayed home, he tried to work the farm, he tried to care for his mom, he tried to have a family, and just couldn't keep it together. And yet, there's still a bond there. And I can't think of the last time that I saw, I want to say, a familial bond on screen that was as accurate as this.
Yeah.
And I'm open for being corrected, but like I said, most of the time, I just don't feel like people can do that much character development in such a short amount of time, and care about both these things. I mean, even at some point when Marcus, Jeff Bridges' character, is making fun of Alberto, and he talks, you know, hey, this is what you know, me picking at you is what you're going to miss, and whether that's true or not, like, you do kind of start to see that it's not just one way. Like, you know, Marcus needs Alberto.
Yeah.
And I think there's another factor here that's easy to overlook, that what's bringing both sets of brothers together, particularly Tanner and Toby, is a familial or an economic crisis.
Yeah.
So it's the impending loss of their mother's home. Tanner's just gotten out of prison, and Toby has, quote, "You asked me to do this." Like, he has asked Tanner to come help me with my plan. And so I don't know. I mean, nobody can know because the movie doesn't go this way, but who knows if they would have been this close if there hadn't been that crisis, right? Here's another fascinating parallelism, I think. I actually think there's this, the crisis of a deadline. So you have the crisis of a foreclosed loan happening with Tanner and Toby, and then you have the impending crisis of Marcus's retirement happening on almost exactly the same schedule.
Mm-hmm.
That you have all these teasing lines from Alberto, interestingly, like, you might get a hunt yet, like, the FBI doesn't want this, and ATF or whoever doesn't want this, so you old kind of crotchety Texas Ranger might get to have some fun before you retire. A great reviewer line says, I think this was in, I forget who wrote this, but how does one retire from justice exactly? Like, if you're passionate about pursuing justice, how do you just hang that up? And so you really see that crisis for Marcus, especially. Like, he can't let it go. He's nervous, actually, about his retirement. Yeah. And it comes out, especially after he's forced to retire.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, because he still goes back to the station and is trying to look through files, and they're telling him, "You're retired, you know that."
Mm-hmm.
And yet he's still following the case because it compels him so much.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's interesting that you use the word justice, or that, well, even the reviewer used the word justice in relation to Marcus, because there seems to be a running tension. And like I said, you were all over this a little bit earlier, Elijah, between the desire or the law of justice, or like the law of the land, versus a kind of a moral law, and that back and forth. And another thing we'd mentioned actually on Sunday morning was that this almost seems like a, not a retelling, but very allusatory to Les Mis.
Mm.
Like, you have someone who is in Marcus's character, in Jeff Bridges' character, who is dedicated to the law of the land.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think in this film tries very hard to ask you, is that also justice?
Mm-hmm.
So there's this tension. So you have him as the Javert, and then you have Chris Pine's character Toby as the Jean Valjean. You know, like the mm-hmm. person who needs to steal out of necessity because it may be the morally right choice to do.
Right.
Or is it? Like, anytime, is it okay to, mm-hmm. Go against the law of land? And as Christians, we have a lot to consider in that vein. And so I'd ask you, Hunter, like what, when you left this movie, what kind of moral dilemma was created inside you, specifically in regards to, like, justice versus the law?
I think what I found most challenging is, and it's something that I've been thinking about a lot, just given a lot of the conflict in our country between classes,
mm-hmm.
Is that question of, is morality, is ethics a conversation that can happen only in a privileged situation?
Mm.
You know, if you are starving, can you have a conversation about whether it's right to steal a loaf of bread? Or, I mean, mm-hmm. that's the Jean Valjean example, I guess.
Yeah.
But, it is kind of hard to look at this situation in West Texas and think, gosh, I mean, sure, if they had a safety net, then they would maybe have other options to look after their mother while Toby was in jail, to provide for Toby's family. But here it's really a desperate situation. You know, the desperation is one of the emotions or feelings that I was struck by again and again in the movie, is these are characters who'd have nothing to catch them. And you see that with a lot of the tiny characters too, or small characters. You know, this, the, when Marcus and Alberto are driving past and they see the fire and these ranchers are trying to move their cattle away.
Yeah.
These ranchers, you know, they're just complaining. They're like, I mean, this is...
Well, no wonder I can't get my kid to want to do this.
Yeah, and they say, they drive away, said they're on, those boys are on their own.
Yeah, it's kind of, yeah. So there is, you know, there is this hopelessness that you see, and yeah, that affects how you view morality. I mean, if you have no hope that if you do the absolute right thing, law of the land, and morally right thing, if you have no hope that, you know, someone or some power is going to, you know, look after you, then yeah, you're going to break any code of ethics or law in order to survive.
When it's really interesting that morality seems to be, well, even the people who seem to, as best we can tell, you know, obviously Toby's character wasn't perfect because, you know, he was divorced and there were some, obviously, some other issues there. But in general, we're to believe that he's been following the law.
Mm-hmm. In fact, they can't even convict him at the end because he has such a clean record.
Yeah, because he's got such a clean
there's
record.
There's nothing on him.
That there's nothing that technically ties him to it except for that he's their brother. So even the people that are following the letter of the law, this goes to the people in the diner too, or the waitress. You know, she doesn't want to break the law, but at the same time, she realizes that the law isn't good enough. It's not helping her pay. You know, she's doing the right thing. She's got a job. She's just trying to be nice to people and, you know, whatever. And she can barely feed, you know, and clothe her kid.
Yeah. And the law might take her tip away.
Yeah. And the law actually is going to take the one good thing that's happened to her in a while away.
Yeah.
And then the other thing that I really liked was, because at first I thought it was a little on the nose, but then I realized if you look at who's saying it and how they're saying it, that when the old men were there just waiting for their chance to vent about things, you know, it wasn't just that they were old men that were waiting for their chance to vent about things. It's that we assume that they're not in jail because they've been doing, you know, they've been abiding by the law of the land.
Yeah.
But they even say, you know, we've been sitting here long enough to watch those boys rob that bank that's been robbing us for 30 years.
Yeah.
So they realize that even though the law is the law and they are under it, or at least trying to obey it or abide by it, that it's broken. And when so many people in the movie readily point out that the law is broken, it's hard not to want to side with someone who's against the law. So I guess I want to know more from you on this, Elijah. Like, Where did this take you morally? Like, did you end up feeling like you were siding with one side or the other? Does the movie tip its hand too heavily?
I don't think it does. And I mean, I think another way to put your question is Tanner a hero?
Yeah.
Or not? Or is he a villain?
That's what I asked. I think it's Hunter. That's what I asked.
That's
right?
What I heard.
Well, I love repeating your questions.
We'll fix it in post.
I'm going to highlight some snippets of this, just kind of this thread of moral dilemma, moral undertones, and even moral justification. So you have Toby telling Tanner, "Brother, you're doing a good thing. What you're doing is a good thing." You have Jeff Bridges saying, no, this is going to haunt you. Is this supposed to haunt him or is it supposed to be a good thing? So it's this opposite counsel from Jeff Bridges' character. And then Ben Foster, you have Tanner's his little monologue about there's this sickness in the land, the sickness called poverty, and like painting the dilemma in even bodily, physical, medical terms, this sickness. You have Tanner's own self-justification, never killed anybody, never hurt anybody. You got Marcus's rebuke, no, you set this in motion, so you're at fault. You have Tanner telling his brother Toby, go easy on the tellers this time, so he's appealing for mercy, even in the midst of a bank robbery.
Backwards. You got Tanner and Toby.
Oh, sorry, Toby's telling Tanner to go easy on the bank tellers. And then my favorite line that I think really reveals Toby's dilemma the most is when he's having a beer with his son. And he tells his son, don't be like me.
Yeah.
And or don't be like us, me and my brother. And his son says, oh, Dad, you know I'm not going to believe that stuff. And he says, no, believe all of it. Just don't be like me. And so he's implicitly acknowledging that he's doing something wrong mm-hmm. here. Yeah. And then the son says, well, so then Toby says, so you're going to drink your beer? And he said, Dad, you just told me not to be like you, so which is it? Do you want me to drink beer like you even though I'm underage, or mm-hmm. do you want me to not be like you? And so I think Toby is implicitly acknowledging that he's having to do a bad thing in order to ultimately do what is in his eyes a good thing,
yeah.
which is to deliver the farm to his sons
yeah.
and to secure the future for his sons. So I think that's the crux of it, and that's the dilemma. And I think this even gets into theology with the televangelist preacher in the hotel room, which is just another parallel of the man, if you want to call the bank the man.
Yeah.
And Jeff Bridges' character Marcus having this debate with Alberto,
yeah.
like is this man speak for God or not? Which is another one of those power, justice, truth things.
Mm-hmm.
So I just think it's so subtle and well done. Like you're so captivated by the character development that you can miss like the deep, deep things that yeah. are being said. But and there's lots more. But I think that's just a snippet of the moral universe that this movie is creating.
When you see kind of a very in this realm of desperation, which I think is you could just call it the human plight. We mm-hmm. live in a broken world. You know, it's not perfect.
Mm-hmm. So
there's got things go wrong. People get victimized, and it creates a cycle. You think of the bank tellers and the bank manager who gets clocked in the face or mm-hmm. on his what did Jeff Bridges call it, like schnozzle or something
yeah
it's something goofy
mm-hmm.
But you know everyone's living in that, everyone's living in this kind of, and they all seem to recognize the guilt of it. I mean particularly Toby, but then you have Tanner who's a little, you might say his conscience is more seared but he does have this great line where Toby's saying, you talk as if we're not going to get away with this.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, I've never seen anyone who's gotten away with anything.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that's a very, I look at it again as a Western primarily, there's a great line. And you have this, what made me think of it from this movie was the scene at the gas station where the, this wannabe gangster drives up and is threatening Tanner with his gun, and Chris Pine just goes up and beats his head against the door mm-hmm. of his car, and the other guy sort of trying to protect himself, he had it coming
yeah,
and there is sort of this law of the land, law between this construct of law of like, well, he deserved it, so it's okay to
yeah.
kind of hurt him.
Even though that was technically illegal.
Yeah, I mean, it was assault.
Everyone could, like, come on and have, like, this mutual...
Yeah,
like
well, we're not going to call the police.
He got
this.
What he deserved,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah.
That was... We all agree that was justice. Don't let it happen
yeah.
to me.
But there was... I mean, there's a great line in the Clint Eastwood movie, Unforgiven. It's got Gene Hackman, Morgan Freeman. It's a great movie where, after the end, there's just been this huge shootout, super violent... And it's Clint Eastwood and this kid, and the kid is like traumatized by what just happened. And he said, still, like, they had it coming, right? And Clint Eastwood says, we all got it coming. Like
yeah.
everyone seems to acknowledge we're all guilty. We're all going to
mm-hmm.
end up getting shot. Or, I mean, especially in Texas, again, you see the
yeah.
hyper gun shootout in the bank. But yeah, there's this acknowledgement, like, we're all guilty. Eventually something's going to catch up with us
mm-hmm.
and it's almost a nihilistic view, like we're all going to die eventually
mm-hmm.
and pay for whatever we've done. So people mm-hmm. respond to that differently
mm-hmm.
Tanner of course seeks
his destruction,
pleasure and thrill, and you know, whatever Toby seeks to kind of hold to this code. And
so, well, what was interesting about Tanner is that he actually had his own moral universe as well that came out several times. It came out with the Comanche, where the Comanche comes up in his face and said, "You know what I am? You're a Comanche. You know what that means? It means I'm the enemy of everybody." And
you know what that makes you?
You know what that makes you? And the assumption is that you're my enemy. And Tanner, Ben Foster, completely turns it on its... He turns the moral question on its head and says, "Nope, that makes me a Comanche. So I'm an enemy of everybody, too." Mm. And he even alludes back to that right before he dies when he looks at the sky and says, "Lord of the Plains, like, I'm a Comanche." He does it again when he's talking to Toby's character about the abuse that their father used to beat he and his brother and their mom. And Toby said, "You didn't seem to realize that the more you fought him, the more he beat you." And Tanner says, "No, I did realize that. That's why I killed him." And so he's like, "No, there." Like Tanner's always finding another solution that's kind of, quote, the immoral solution.
Yeah. Usually,
like,
the violent
solution. Yeah, the violent solution. Like, no, I can just... I know I'm not going to get away with it, but I can actually do the wrong thing in the name of doing the right thing in some ways. So I think, in some ways, Tanner's character was a foil to particularly Toby's character, where he thinks he can get away with it, he can bury the car, etc. But it was also a foil to Jeff Bridges' character in a lot of ways, too.
So where does that leave us? Like, you know, Hunter, you've talked about how it's hard to live in the world, a fallen, broken world, where, as the movie depicts, people who break the law of the land get what's coming to them, and people who follow the law of the land don't really have much more hope in a lot of circumstances. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, and I love the point that you bring up, that, you know, it almost seems like you have to be like a suburbanite to be able to have the time and, you know, resources to sit around and talk about, like, what is moral and when can we have this conversation?
Yeah.
And I love that. So, since we all are suburbanites and can't have this conversation, like, what hope do we have? Because it seems like this movie, if we're to kind of follow Elijah's thinking, that, you know, Toby believes he is doing bad, but also is, you know, he's like 100% bad, but he's 100% doing something bad, but 100% doing something for good. What hope do we have if we can't do it on our own? And I mean, I'm obviously asking a leading question, and we can't rely on, like, the law of the land to make anything any better.
I mean, Christ, is that what? I think.
But so what does that mean tangibly?
Yeah. So I mean,
what is Christ? What is Christ going to give me that I don't get from the law of the land?
Well, I mean, there's a hope beyond what you receive in this world, and that's, you know, that could go towards escapism. We don't want to go there, but I do think in cases that are desperate, you know, you look at the early church. The early church was very poor. It was pretty savage time in the world's history. It's a pretty savage place. And their response was not, "Well, I need to buy a gun. I need to, you know, protect mine and my own."
Are you sure? Because I'm sure if you went to Texas.
Well, I mean, Jesus, I think, did say, "Unsheathe your swords" in the Garden of Gethsemane. That was, no.
He said, "Fight!
Yeah.
Fight!"
And I don't want to get into that. I don't want to get into, like, "Is it okay to have a gun conversation?" That's a that's a minefield. But, you know, at the same time, the answer to "we live in a broken world," you know, I think the Christian answer is not first, therefore we need to protect ourselves with armaments and worldly power. I mean, that's the world's wisdom, is power solves your problem. Money solves your problems. I think Christian answer is that Christ solves our problems, and now you can look at an area like Texas and you think, gosh, it's desolate. Is God actually there? And, you know, again, that's where the tension comes in. I'm living in a pretty wealthy situation. I have a roof over my head at night. I have a car that has three of its hubcaps. And,
it's pretty good. I like the mods.
Yeah. And, you know, so I can say, well, if they just have more faith,
mm-hmm.
you know, they would persevere.
Or maybe whatever you believe becomes truth.
But at the end of the day, I think there is a choice to be made. And it's for us, you know, I haven't had to struggle with that quite as much as someone who mm-hmm. lived in the early church or who lives in the Middle East right now or who lives in, you know, rural Alabama or Texas or, you know, a more violent, dangerous place. So, but, you know, that's what I would say, I think.
So how does that, what does that look like? What does that relief look like in Christ? Is it, like I said, because you say we don't want to go to escapism.
Right.
We don't want to just say, well, life sucks. At least I'm going to go to heaven. Like, how does the hope of Christ change someone's outlook in a hypothetical West Texas setting?
Yeah, well, I think one is, you know, the body of Christ is a safety net that we don't have governmentally in a lot of places.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the body of Christ, you look at, again, looking at scripture, you look at the collection that was being taken up by Paul and Barnabas for Judea because they knew there was going to be a famine in Judea. And there were, I mean, you can make the argument, well, these are all poor people. How are they supposed to, you know, support each other? Well, the people in these churches that Paul and Barnabas were visiting were very poor,
mm-hmm.
but they still gave for the sake of their brothers and sisters in a place of the world they'd never been. So I think that's one area that is a tangible, palpable fulfillment of the hope we have in Christ is the body builds itself up and supports itself. So that would be one answer.
No, that's good. That actually makes me think of another thing that I wrote down when I was just kind of taking some time to reflect about the movie, because the movie does gray morality mm-hmm. in a lot of places. I mean, or it at least asks us to define our own morality.
Yeah.
Like, where would we draw our lines? Where would we bend the rules? Where is the, you know, laws of the land good enough? Where do we need to take action on mm-hmm. ourselves? And everyone's kind of got a moral compass. You know, even if we say that Marcus is the Javert and his compass is too strict, you know, there's not enough flexibility in it. Or if we say that Tanner's is too loose, you know, and it's too self-involved.
Mm.
Everyone seems to have a moral compass in the film, except for the banks. The banks are only beholden to the bottom line.
Mm.
They don't have any moral compass.
Mm.
I would say that the banks aren't, they're neither good nor bad. They are motivated.
Mm.
And I think...
And savvy. They know how to work the system. Well, so yeah, they fax the letter a day too late. Oops, yeah. We're sorry. We know you turned it in, but you were a little bit late.
Yeah.
Processing took too long.
Yeah. So the banks are, oddly enough, one of the only ways, or one of the only people in the film that we can 100% dislike because we can agree with Marcus on some level, right? Mm-hmm. You know, you need to not kill people, you need to not rob banks. We can agree with, you know, Toby or Tanner on some levels, like you need to be able to not get, you know, bamboozled or have your stuff taken because hard times, you know, mm-hmm. You should be able to provide for your family.
Yeah.
Like, but I would say, or I would posit that we are beings made to desire justice mm-hmm. or to desire some type of moral code.
Mm-hmm.
And so what is almost more appalling than questionable morality is an absence of morality.
Mm.
And so there's this bank as, and this is what I'm fine with people pushing back, because like I said, I was just kind of spinning the wheels. Like, that's why the banks are evil, because they don't have... They're about making money. Like, if they do good things, they don't care. If they do bad things, they don't care, as long as it makes them more money.
Yeah.
Because at the end of the movie, like, well, we see them doing bad things, but at the end of the movie, they let, basically, Toby get away with it.
Yeah.
The banks are completely fine. Like, even if Toby was implicit, they're like, well, we're making tons of money right now, so we don't care if he robbed us. So, like I said, they don't have this moral code.
Yeah. So, I would say that there's actually a flawed premise. So, I'm going to... even though I've said this is the best movie of the year, hands down, I'm going to point out what I think is a flawed premise in this movie.
How can it be the best if it has a flaw?
Because nobody's Jesus.
Oh, gosh.
We're all imperfect until the perfect comes. Go read 1 Corinthians 13. Mm. So here's,
dang. Just told you to go read the Bible.
So here's the flawed premise, I think, in the movie. And I like to expose it by asking a question. If everybody in West Texas or the country had $1 million and everybody was reading at grade level and everybody had reasonably good health, mm-hmm. and food in their pantry, mm-hmm. would everything be okay in West Texas? I would say no.
Definitely.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
And this is a question that we've asked in different ways before, because I think when we talked about, oddly enough, or not oddly enough, appropriately enough, when we talked about The Big Short,
right.
we asked a very similar question, you know, also about a banking crisis, being like, oh, we learned our lesson. Will this ever happen again? Right. Of course it will, because yeah. people will always be greedy, because
yeah.
no matter how much people have, people are always people, right?
Right. So you've got that aspect that if the movie is oversimplistic, and it's way more complex than most movies, but if it's oversimplistic, it's oversimplistic in seeming to advocate that a material solution will equals justice, okay? Yeah. So if I keep my farm, then justice has been done. I would say that a material answer to justice is not... The justice involves material implications and solutions, but it is not the exhaustive. It is not the totality of justice. So that's the concept. Let me spill it out in terms of the movie. Here's how you know justice is not completely done. So one of the things you see is that each of the bank robberies gets more and more chaotic, more and more out of control, so that the last bank robbery, they have to go to the big town, they go in the lobby, and it's like, oh my goodness, we're about to rob 100 people standing in line, not rob them, we're going to rob the bank with 100 people's lives on the line, so to speak. And in fact, two of them, I think, at least die in that bank robbery. Mm-hmm. So the movie, to its credit, shows not simple bank robberies, but increasingly fraught bank robberies. Mm-hmm. So that's a problem for the justice of the movie. The other big problem, I think, is that Toby is not with his family at the end of the movie.
Yeah.
They've got a house, but he's not with them. He's coming to do homework, but he's not with his wife. They're not together.
The money doesn't reconcile
them. The money did not reconcile the marriage relationship, or even necessarily an ongoing presence of a father-son relationship. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, you can do homework, but that's just kind of furthering the materialistic solution idea of if you get an education, everything will be all right. Like, it'll help, but no, it won't all be all right. So I think there's some implicit holes in this idea of if we could just keep the farm, everything will be okay. So to your point, I'm going to go back to why this is the best movie of the year and tie it into this. So I'm point counterpointing myself. But so how does the movie say everything that we're saying in one shot? End of the movie, you have this panoramic shot. The camera rises from the farmhouse, which they're keeping, and it goes to look at what? It goes to look at all these oil fields pumping up and down, showing, wow, it worked out. They're making a bazillion dollars, whatever. But then where does it go after it goes to the panoramic aerial shot? It goes back in, and the credits roll as the camera is literally sitting in the weeds.
Yeah.
And you're looking in the grass, seeing everybody's name go through weeds as the backdrop to the screen. So I think the movie is saying visually, like, here's how it worked out for them, but here's where you are. Like, y'all, the audience, are all in the weeds still, trying to figure out how to get out of the weeds. And so I think the moral universe that the movie creates is compelling but incomplete. I would put it that way. How does that get solved? I think it gets solved through advocacy. So you have the attorney that says, let me tell you how to cover your tracks. Mm. So he's using the law to advocate for better justice. I won't say true justice, yeah, but better justice for them. So advocacy on one another's behalf, yeah, I think, being true to serpents. And then I'll close by quoting one of the emperors, to Hunter's point earlier, one of the emperors at the time of the early church, Roman emperor, complained to one of his local governors about Christians, saying, quote, they not only take care of their own poor, they take care of ours as well. And so he's lamenting how well Christians take care of not only, quote, their own poor people in the church, but the poor that are part of the pagan religious structure as well, that's making the pagan civic religions of Rome look bad. And so I think the problem with rich and poor isn't that you have more than me. The problem is that it reveals a lack of care. And so I think that's the question. That's the deeper question behind wealth and poverty, is do we care for one another in poverty, or are we kind of self-satisfied? So it's not about the material, like, I have to have X for this to be justice. It's, do you really care that your brother is hurting? And I think the movie says, yeah, the banks don't care, so that's bad. But what is the solution, I think, is the bigger question.
Well, that plays in too, or at least based on the way what I'm hearing, is it plays into a lot of why the motel scene between Marcus and Alberto is really good, when the Joel Osteen is on TV there doing, you know, saying things like, whatever you believe becomes the truth, you know, basically trying to name things like, think about yourself, get more stuff. That's the, you know, the road to happiness, a very prosperity gospel,
yeah,
type message, naming it and claiming it. It's very self-focused, which, I mean, I would say is pretty antithetical to the gospel.
Yeah.
Which I would say is pretty others focused, or Christ focused, which makes us other focused.
Yeah, when it's, again, it's the wisdom of the world that Christ is not our hope. Our hope is still things, but Christ is a means to those
things,
to money or power, or, you know, whatever we need to really survive. And yeah, and you know, Jeff Bridges' character is like, that's not right.
Well, and doesn't the movie have to settle on its own moral justification with, quote, a do it for the kids mentality? So you could take the worst, like, prison, like, the worst behaving person in the world, and you just say, will you give to a good cause? It's for the kids.
It's for the kids.
And like, oh, you just melted my heart. It's for the kids. And so I think if there's anything that's a little cliche-ish, I think it's the scene at the end where Toby walks out the door and he says, I'll be back to help them with their homework tomorrow. And it's the whole, I didn't do it for myself, I did it for the kids thing. And it's like, okay, that's noble of you, but if you're going to rob a bank, sure, do it for the kids. That's the best, that's the best moral justification, I guess, a modern secular thinker can come up with. And so I think that's lacking at the end of the day, because, again, it's exposed in his conversation with his son. Why would you tell me not to do something that you're doing? But, yeah.
Well, it's interesting to me because, like, on one level, it seemed like it was kind of throwing out, like, a do it for the kids for sympathy's sake. For, like, oh, this is another reason to justify it. But I think it was also, again, based on what I'm seeing, trying to make a point that I think we've already at least debunked with how we see the world, which is poverty is, like, systemic.
Yeah.
You know, like, once you get into that cycle,
mm-hmm,
it not only, like, it's something that you basically stay in as a cycle, but then it basically affects everyone around you.
Don't they call it in the movie, like, a generational disease,
yeah,
or something?
You know?
Yeah.
And so the thing here is, the idea that if we can materialistically get out of this, mm-hmm, disease, or cure ourselves of this disease, like, the children, the next generation will not have it.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. In fact, he says that, but not my boys.
But not my boys. Which I think goes back to what you were saying earlier. You know, like if everyone in West Texas had $1 million and all could read and stuff, would West Texas be fine? Mm-hmm. And I think that's the thing. So if his boys grow up, having at least lived a little bit of their lives, you know, this is what we get with the difference between like first and second generation immigrants. Mm-hmm. You know, first generation immigrants have nothing. They work all their life. They don't like have this idea or concept of retirement or vacation or, I mean, not in every term, but like in lots of examples. And then their kids grow up in America and they expect this and they expect that and they get used to this. Mm-hmm. And so they don't typically work as hard. I mean, which reflects most of the youth in America in general. And then they pass that on to their kids, and they actually put themselves back into a cycle of poverty when that one generation was given almost everything from that first generation of parents. You know, like I have friends who are second generation of their parents, like, will buy them a car and won't ever go on vacation so they can pay for their kids' college and then pay for their kids' like house and then, you know, just pay for everything because they're like, we didn't have this, you have to have it. And that's what I see Toby doing here, being like, I grew up and it was terrible. So maybe his kids grew up poor long enough, maybe the football kid grew up poor long enough that he knows what it's like so he can be more responsible with his $50,000 a month. But in all likelihood, when his kids grow up, they're going to grow up never wanting for anything and never knowing what it's like to not have. And so then it's going to be circular. So like I said, I think that's why it's a false resolution. And that's why I don't know. When this movie was written, did, you know, what was the writer's name? Taylor Sheridan. Did he say, I'm putting this forth as something you can get behind as a way to break the cycle of poverty? Or am I pointing out how this is just another false victory for getting out of the cycle of poverty? Because it's just going to come back around. Like, if people really think about it, they realize it's going to just come back around.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's definitely posing the question, and intentionally so. I think what makes the movie different, it's not just doing armchair philosophy, like, hey, here's some thoughts. It's actually showing a guy that went and did the thing. He came up with a solution, which is part of what makes it a compelling and a provocative movie, is that this guy, Toby, kind of went over the line and got away with it. And is that good or bad that he got away with it? And so I think, if of all the movies that have holes in them, I think this movie has far fewer holes than most. And obviously I'm pointing out what I think is a spiritual hole that a material solution can't solve the problems of the human heart. And though it is an indicator of, again, our quality of care for each other and things like that, I think this also raises some interesting questions about government and family and community. So if a law was made that made the banks do something better than they were doing, like from the top down, would that solve everything? Or would somebody else just find out another way to come and take everybody's land away? And so I think how a community... Like, a lot of people in the movie are just kind of stuck and paralyzed, observing bad things happening around them. And Toby's unique in that he takes action. But I think most people are not like Toby. Most people are like the other characters in the movie, just observing bad things happen and kind of critiquing the world around them. And in some senses, to comfort themselves, like, isn't this bad? Yeah, this is bad. I'm glad I'm not as bad as everything that's happening around me.
Well, it does. It does raise questions about government, and I think that's something to think about, because we often, I feel like there's, you know, like most things that we argue about in this country, there seems to be only two sides of it. When I think if you actually have a discussion, the answer is probably somewhere closer to the middle.
Yeah.
Because on one side, there would be people who see like the people in West Texas, and they're like, well, if they just worked harder, they wouldn't need the government to help them. They wouldn't be being screwed over by the banks. And I don't want to be told to help these people out. I want to be able to do it out of the kindness of my heart and freely. But they might
not do it.
And then not do it. Or maybe do it.
Yeah.
You know? There are plenty of very wealthy, very generous people. So on the other side, there's like, look, we can't count on people to do it themselves. So, you know, so we need the government to step in and help these people. And it doesn't matter if they don't ever actually pull themselves up. It's our responsibility to care for the people in this country, even at the expense, unwillfully, of the people who do have something. And those typically be the two conversations that you have about what the role of government is.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And the answer is probably somewhere in the middle.
Yeah.
You know, depending on where you maybe slightly one side or the other, but somewhere in the middle, you know, the government should probably try to help out its citizens to some degree to, you know, to make sure that they won't get cheated or bamboozled.
Yeah.
You know, but at the same time, it can't force people to be charitable. The government also can't fix the human heart.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, if you'll talk to somebody in Child Protective Services, we don't want to be in charge of raising kids. Like, if there's another family solution where an uncle or an aunt mm-hmm. or somebody could step in. So, especially as what's sometimes called the social fabric frays, and families are less connected and more isolated and less able to care for one another, the government's job in a lot of ways gets harder and harder and more impossible. And so I think even people I've talked to who work typically in a local city or county government, they'll say, we don't want to be responsible for everybody's kids or mm-hmm. Solutions. Like, that's, we aren't cut out for that job.
Yeah, that's rough. So the last piece that I want to ask you guys about, I mean, obviously I'll give you a chance to raise anything else, but is something that we have actually hit on here and there, and I think it's twofold. One is something I believe, again, Hunter, you pointed out, where not Toby, but Tanner says, like, I never met nobody got away with anything ever.
Yeah.
You? This is a concept that there's, like, almost like a justice that's unsaid.
Hmm.
You know, like, there is something else going on. Hmm. Like, there's, like, almost like a karma, it would seem like. You know, like, yeah. Everyone gets caught, kind of. Or almost, maybe even saying everyone's guilty. And then there's this showdown, which probably, spoiler for me, is one of my favorite part of the movie. The showdown. This very intense face conversation. Off. Yes. This modern Western face-off.
Yes.
Where someone, like, two people have a gun, but you're not standing at each other at the end of a street.
Yeah.
You're on the front porch sharing a beer with tension. Mm. And there's this idea of fault and people not being able to get away with things.
Mm.
And it all leads to this idea that Toby is proclaiming his innocence in as vague a way as possible, you know, not to admit technically to anything, but to kind of play the hypothetical game. And Marcus is saying, was all, whatever you did, was it worth four people dying?
Mm.
And Toby's like, I didn't kill anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And Marcus is like, you did.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting to me, because one of the questions that I asked Elijah when we left was, well, I think Elijah said something to the effect of, like, you know, you really love that question. Like, you know, is it Toby's fault? Like, is it his fault that four people died? And I would say, I think either a companion or better question that's not being asked is that is it also equally Marcus's fault? Is it Marcus's fault that Alberto dies?
Hmm.
Because Alberto says on many occasions, like, you're getting ready to retire. You don't need to chase these people. Why don't we just go get the fingerprints? You know, if he didn't push Alberto because of his, you know, Javert-like, you know, need for justice, or at least the law of the land justice, then Alberto and him would probably be drinking coffee back at the station.
Hmm.
And, you know, his reluctant friend and partner and brother, to a certain degree, would still be alive. So I would say that, like, no one's blameless. But would you be able to assign fault anywhere, Hunter? Like, do you think it's more someone's fault? Do you think it's the individual, you know, do you think it's just Tanner's fault? Like, cause he's the one that killed people. How far out does the blame go? Is anyone truly blameless? Oh gosh. Are these leading questions?
I mean, I would definitely answer no to the last question. Nobody's truly blameless. Yeah, I mean, everyone was involved in the cycle of violence. And you even see that in that last scene that you talked about, where there's this tension and both characters clearly have the view that justice would be one of them shooting the other. Like, justice for Marcus would be him, you know, killing the man he sees as partially responsible for Alberto's death.
Mm-hmm.
And,
or at least the way he's, I think he's considered fully responsible. I think he doesn't.
Yeah, I mean,
I don't
he
even
is
think
the
he
mastermind,
blames,
I guess.
I don't even think he blames Tanner in his mind at this
point. Yeah, Tanner
point.
Was more of, I guess, like the...
He's just a tool that
the
he
mad
used.
Dog, you know, chasing the car, mm-hmm. just wanting the thrill. And, you know, but then Toby, for good reason, sees the man who actually did pull the trigger to kill his brother mm-hmm. and would say, well, you know, I need to... You know, there. So there's this tension of revenge for them is justice. And the only reason they don't settle it right then and there is this sort of veneer of civility that is forced on them by the family arriving.
The hogs got out. Yeah. I have my rifle because the hogs got out.
Yeah. So, but as far as, I mean, assigning blame, man, I mean.
Because I would even say that furthermore, one of the things that we haven't even tried to assign blame to are the people who have taken it upon themselves to try to be a hero in a situation. I mean,
yeah.
Like, if you don't, like, other people who didn't get up and try to shoot anybody in the bank didn't get shot.
Right. Yeah.
Security guard tried to be a hero.
Yeah. Now, I mean, you could argue he was trying to do his job, too.
He was trying to do his job.
Yeah, I mean, I think you could... I would place some blame on Marcus for Alberto's death, not so much because of his passion, because there was the passion for justice, but there was also, I think, for him, just a purely selfish motive of, I don't want to retire,
mm-hmm.
I want the thrill of the hunt. And so he was pushing Alberto past his limits and putting him in this very dangerous situation. But yeah.
Also this, too, though, about Alberto's death. Alberto's death revealed Marcus's heart and character towards Alberto more than anything else in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
So you have him almost breaking down physically and definitely emotionally, crawling out into the line of fire to pull back his partner, weeping, and then he collects himself, goes on top of the mountain, shoots Tanner, and then breaks down again on top of the mountain. So I think... it's interesting, what does Alberto's death reveal about Marcus, and then what does Toby's, or what does Tanner's death reveal about Toby? And I almost feel like Marcus reacted more heartfelt towards his partner's death than Tanner did about Toby's death.
Well, I think I would say that it wasn't more heartfelt. I would say it was more of a realization. I think Toby already knew how he felt about Tanner. I think Marcus was lying to himself about how he felt about Alberto.
Right, but you didn't see the same tears and the same like shock from
but
Toby.
Already,
real men don't cry.
That's right.
So.
That's true. It's in the Bible.
Yeah.
Well, but I would say that Toby said goodbye to Tanner already.
Yeah but even at the parting of the cars, where are you going? It's not like a little big brother, don't do this. All right, like it's a little bit dispassionate. It feels like to me how Toby lets Tanner go, not knowing really what he's up to, but maybe having a clue. But anyway, my point is that there is something good in a sense that comes out of Alberto's death, in terms of Marcus's own character realizing that I really loved my partner.
But then I would say that it manifests itself into a redoubled addiction to this thing that he was addicted to.
Yeah, I would challenge the premise there. Is pursuing justice an addiction? I mean, addiction has a negative connotation.
But what is justice? Was justice?
Well, that's what I'm saying. That's why at the very beginning
the cycle
of the episode,
of violence again.
Yeah, the very beginning of the episode, I said you use the word justice, but I find it very hard to use the word justice in its purest, or as pure as we can for mm-hmm. human terms,
right.
use the word justice for what Marcus was doing. Well, I would say he was pursuing the law.
I don't think it was even that, because he says what he's pursuing on the front porch. He says, how'd you do it? No, don't tell me that. I'll figure that one out. Why did you do it? So what he really wants is to understand the heart and the character behind Tanner and Toby's actions, which I think is something even beyond justice. It's more, I'm a lawman, but I want to understand human character and human motivation. So I think the same logic that lays blame at the foot of the banks also lays blame at Toby's feet as well. You can't say the banks are just doing what they're supposed to do and that they don't deserve any blame for the intended or unintended outcomes of their actions, and say that Toby was doing the same thing. In other words, he did set something in motion. He is responsible for what he set in motion. Surely he wouldn't say, if he had it to do over again, I want four people to die in the process of keeping my farm.
Well, that's true, but I would push back and say, so you are saying that Marcus was interested in, like, really understanding where they were. I would say that I think if he was actually interested in understanding what made Toby tick, or why Toby did what he did, he would have been able to enter that situation with the ability to have his mind changed. And there was nothing that makes me believe that Marcus had any intention of changing his mind about anything. He went there for himself and to exact revenge in the way, the law that should have been laid out the way that he sees it and worshiped it.
I think that's an open question, though, because they both come up to the edge and they both back away. One reviewer brought out something brilliant that I hadn't even picked up. They both say, why don't you come over to my place and I'll give you peace?
Mm-hmm.
Like, you're obviously dissettled now. Let me give you some peace. Says, or maybe I'll give you peace.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're from a liturgical Anglican, Catholic, Lutheran setting, this is called the exchange of the peace. And so I think you have a scene there where they're offering to exchange violent peace, but never really doing it. And Marcus even says, like, you could shoot me right now and you would be within your rights. So he knows the law is actually on Toby's side,
yeah.
But he is exposing himself to his own just shooting, being killed by Toby, not because of the law, I don't think, so much as this hunger to know and to understand what caused this whole scene to unfold. And I think Toby answers the question without confessing guilt, that my kids aren't going to grow up poor like I did, mm-hmm. my parents did, my grandparents did. So I think there's something deeper at work than justice, because either one of them could have pulled the trigger or gone back later on to pull the trigger, but I don't think they ever did.
Mm. Well, and I want to be clear that I'm not saying that the film doesn't raise a great question, or at least make a great point that it's not just the banks that are to blame. Like,
yeah.
Toby mm-hmm. has
yeah.
something to do with this. Tanner has something to do with this. But I would say that it's actually a three-way tie, that I would say Marcus, Toby, and the banks all have set this in motion. And we have other players that come in and out of this game.
Hmm.
But these are the players, and it's their decisions that have led to the consequences of them trying to fix this problem.
Mm-hmm.
That, as we've said before, isn't a problem that can be fixed by material means.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So, and we all just agreed, I think.
Yeah, I mean,
what have we done? No, done. We'd all agree.
All right, thanks for listening to this podcast.
Yeah.
No, go ahead.
So I'm going to bring up one other thing.
Like, okay.
This is the most ambiguous and fascinating scene to me,
ooh.
Which I feel like I understand a lot of the other stuff and symbolism and parallelism that's going on. I don't quite yet understand this one. So Marcus has just shot Tanner at 500 yards with another guy's gun who wanted to shoot it Texas Justice style, but the Texas Ranger had to do it to be legit and lawful. And then, so the camera, Tanner has just said, I'm the Lord of the Plains. He's taken out the guys down below, the law enforcement. I'm the Lord of the Plains. He gets shot in the head. He slumps over, sitting on this rock, and then the camera pans down to a rattlesnake that's literally right at his heel. Yeah. So I think that's symbolic. So the question for me is, what is the symbolism of the rattlesnake? Is it representative of Tanner, who's the rattlesnake striking out? Is it representative of Marcus, who got the better end on Tanner? Or is it representative of something else that finally took Tanner under? Or, to be even more provocative, combining all three of those, is it an allusion to Genesis 3? I will strike him on the head, the seed of the serpent. This is after Adam and Eve were expelled from the garden. The seed of the serpent will strike the son of the of Eve on the heel, right where the rattlesnake is in relation to Tanner. But the seed of the woman will crush the head of the serpent. So I think there may be a biblical allusion there, with probably Tanner in particular getting struck down on the heel, so to speak, by the serpent. But anyway, I feel like that's an intentional scene, but I'm not sure quite the symbolism that it's trying to convey.
So I want there to be some kind of biblical allusion, you know, selfishly for the podcast, but
therefore
there is one, because whatever I believe becomes the truth.
You need your own TV show.
I do.
You made big bucks.
But when I saw that, it looked to me just like a picture of, like, death was always right there next to Tanner. He just never knew it.
Interesting.
So, you know, like, he was always, his ticket was always punched. You know, he's saying, I'm the Lord of the Plains, but there's a rattlesnake, right? You know, he just doesn't even know. Like, or maybe he does, and he doesn't care. But he you know, he's always inches from death, and it just looks like a representation. Like, this is what it looked like to be this man. I mean, like I said, that's the most beautiful way that I could see it.
And could the snake maybe in some senses represent Tanner's spirit? Like, this is who he was, alluding back to his cabin where you have the flag of the snake coiled up that says, don't tread on me. Like, so he's already claimed that flag and that snake as a symbol that speaks for him in some sense, or represents him. That'd be another way to look at it.
So maybe he's collected a lot of bad karma in his life, so he's like downgraded. He
got turned into a snake.
Reincarnated.
Yeah, it was fast forwarded.
Yeah.
I guess I would look at it more as the rattlesnake symbolizing, again, like the law of nature, which is kind of close to karma, actually, you know, we live in this sucky, broken world, and the material answer, which is what all the characters are seeking, isn't actually a solution, because death is always just around the corner or right at our heels. Yeah, so right at the moment that we think we've arrived.
Interesting.
You know, right at the moment when Toby has arrived, he's got the farm, he's got the oil wells, you know, then it goes down to the weeds, and you're like, well, we're all going to die and be pushing up daisies, to use gangster talk. And then Tanner, right at the moment of his, I'm the Lord of the Plains.
Yeah.
You know, he's seconds away from death, both by bullet or by rattlesnake bite. So there is this sort of human folly statement I think you could draw from that scene as well.
Doesn't he look back over his shoulders right before he gets shot, and like he senses that there's somebody behind him?
It certainly seemed to point that way, because he looks like, and he sees kind of like
a glint of the scope or something.
He like knows it's coming.
Yeah.
But like I said, to me, that like him just doing the entire like I'm Lord of the Plains is him like fully embracing like who he was never allowed to be. You know, like he's always Tanner in a non-Tanner friendly world. You know, he gets
everyone's enemy.
Yeah, he's the Comanche.
Literally at the end.
Yeah, he is the evil here. He is the their antagonist to the entire world he lives in, and it's not until he finally embraces who he thinks he is meant to be, which is completely lawless, doing unfortunate things, where he actually feels like he is who he is, which is pretty depressing, actually.
Yeah.
But I think speaks volumes, and is a, well, I'd say a pretty brilliant end to his character.
Yeah.
You know, because he is destruction. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah, his brother says, I don't know how you stayed out of jail for a year.
So, but also interesting because, you know, there's that scene, it goes back to the brother thing, where he is looking out for his brother. Seeing, like, kind of almost seemingly selfishly when the woman seems like, you know, comes up to him in the bar and is obviously kind of trying to get him to go back to his room. And, you know, Tanner knows what that looks like.
Yeah.
Tanner's
yeah.
like, I've seen this world. This is my world.
It's kind of street smart nature about him.
Kind of, so it does a whole bunch of things. It shows that, you know, he knows what's going on. He doesn't want other people to live the way he lives. And he does have some modicum of compassion.
Yeah.
Like I said, he does obviously care for his brother, even though we don't know what that relationship ultimately would have looked like if they didn't come, like, you know, side by side. And there obviously was some distance or tension between them, that them being on the same mission or like-minded, you know, we see that scene where they're wrestling and stuff and they seem to have come together. And it's amazing what common mission and common goal can do. I think that says a lot.
Yeah.
I think we've gone about the time we need to go, that I beg of people every week or every three times a month. So we will wind down by asking you guys, Hunter, do you have any final thoughts that you'd like to throw out there? Anything that you just really enjoy we didn't talk about? Anything that you know, you didn't get, or just like a commending of the film?
I mean, I think, and again, going back to the idea of this film being sort of a Western, I think one issue they handled really well that we actually didn't really talk about was the Alberto's Native American heritage. You know, that one dialogue by the diner where they're watching out at the bank, and he was talking about, all this land used to be my people's, and then, you know, all these people, their great grandparents came and took it from them, and now the banks are taking it from them. And just, but seeing his identity, you know, you see it throughout the movie, because Marcus is so awful in the way that he is, you know, constantly ribbing him with these awful racist comments, and you do see this. I mean, after reading some of the reviews and thinking about the movie again, you know, it isn't just the that old man. There really actually is some, I think, some real pain there of, you know, this old white guy is able to get away with saying these awful things about his younger partner. Even though the old guy might have affection for him, and, you know, Alberto, I think, did have some affection for Marcus too. Yeah, so just seeing Alberto's plight, in a sense, his situation as a Native American, living in the white man's world, you know, as a white hat Texas Ranger, you know, and yeah, not really seeing, I mean, not seeing any other Native Americans really in the film, because they've been marginalized, pushed, I mean, except in the casino.
The casino, yeah.
You know, they've been pushed to these margins. I thought that was really well handled. That was a really good scene. And
I think it goes back to, like, the film, I really do think, is trying to point out, or at least trying to make a case to some degree, that the things we see are systemic. And I don't think it goes deep enough, like we've talked about why it's systemic. I think it would, you know, if we sit and think and we really take that conversation in, I think it points to the things that we're alluding to, that, you know, that used to be the Native Americans' lands, and then the white people came and took it. So this is something that happened way before there were banks to come and do it. You know, this is something inherent in humanity. Like, they're going to take it and they're going to displace people, and then something's going to come and take it from them and displace it from them. And it's not until we're the ones that are displaced that we can really understand that there's a problem.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you think of the United States conquest of North America, according to the laws of our country, that was legal, mm-hmm. what we did to the Native Americans back in the day. And just like it was legal for the banks to do what they did to these helpless people. So there's that issue of just because it's legal doesn't mean it's right.
Yeah.
I think there's a strong undertone of, you said the movie nihilist, the word nihilistic earlier. I wrote that question down. Is this movie nihilistic? I think you see it particularly in this question of does might make right? Mm-hmm. And if you can take it, should you take it? So Toby had an exceptionally violent brother who was good at getting things and killing people. Like if he had had a meek brother or a law-abiding brother who hadn't been in prison, and he hadn't had a brother who had a AK-47 or whatever that was that chased all the people who wanted to pursue justice away with a bigger gun. So that scene actually in itself really captured this question of might makes right. The bigger mm-hmm. gun got its way. And that was the scene right before they split up in cars and going to the end of the movie. So I think that question what makes something just, because the banks can do it, should they, because Toby could do it, should he, is a larger question that the movie kind of presents, but maybe leaves a bit unexamined. It just says this is what happened. It doesn't necessarily say it was right or wrong that it happened.
Mm. Does that cover it all for you,
yeah,
Hunter?
Sure.
No, I'm really glad you brought that up because I remember there was a person I talked to about the film and they said that scene where Alberto talks about like the history. Like I'm like, oh man, like because there's so many good scenes in the film. Like I'm just I keep running through them all in my head.
Yeah.
Well, Elijah, same thing. Any final thoughts? Like I said, anything that you just really wanted to mention that you hadn't had a chance to, or commending things that made you scratch your head, anything?
No, I mean, the more I think about it, the more I love it, and I just encourage people to go see it. I was actually in Starbucks today right next to Red Cinemas,
mm-hmm.
so when we went to see it last week, it was only showing at one movie theater in the whole triad.
Mm-hmm.
I checked again, it's now showing at two or three theaters just in Greensboro, so it's going wider screen. So anyway, I'm at Starbucks right next to Red Cinemas, and an elderly lady comes over and I hear her talking about the movie and she said, I went to see this movie, kind of a Western. I didn't think I'd like it, but I kind of liked it a lot. And so like it's hitting all the demographics, all the generations. The masses are going to see Hell or High Water. And so I think it's worth going to see just for the conversations that it stirs up.
Yeah.
Just like the one we've had tonight. I would highly recommend the movie.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's got some, you know, it's got language and it's got some tough things and there's obviously some violence in it. But we're not really here to police that, but it isn't like everyone should go see it. But I think if you're really looking for something good, especially this time of year when kind of there's still some stinkers
mm-hmm.
out there in the theater,
mm-hmm.
this is an excellent, I mean, one of the reasons we're doing this episode is because you almost always have to wait to see what, like, the diamond in the rough of, you know, like, the mid to late August.
There's that
early
oil
September.
That barren wasteland.
That's right, you know. And I think this is one of those films.
Definitely.
I hope it sticks around for a while. I hope it garners some attention now, so it garners mm-hmm. more attention when it's more important for movies to garner attention, you know, later in the year, an award season, because I think there are some great performances here that mm-hmm. I know there's some really good movies coming out. Hopefully they're going to be good as they look. Yeah, fingers crossed. A little bit of redemption for 2016, but I would not be sad, at least at this point, if Chris Pine, Ben Foster, or Jeff Bridges are mentioned.
Definitely
around award season.
Mm-hmm.
So. Well, I don't have much else either except to say, you know, yeah, I mean, I was almost scared to go see this movie because so many people had started telling me that it was really good and couldn't really tell me why because they didn't want to ruin anything for me. And it was really kind of like at the beginning of the show we were talking about, kind of hard to explain
yeah.
what is this movie about and like why is this so good. And so I was sitting in the theater with, you know, all you guys, the most people I'd seen a movie with in quite a while. And I was like, just don't let this be bad. And I just, there was like,
you were happily surprised.
And it wasn't.
And it wasn't. And I was like, I wonder if everyone is enjoying this as much as I do. I hope no one says they hate this movie. I'm just gonna be like, what? So that's great. Yeah. So I would also encourage people to check it out if you get a chance. If you're just hankering for something that's, you know, not like a late summer blockbuster flop. So, well, with that said, we have great conversations because we have great guests. So I want you to be able to follow and continue conversations with our guests. So if there was something in the movie that you saw that we didn't talk about, or Hunter or Elijah said something and you don't feel like we answered the question good enough or followed up good enough, you know, respond. You can do it on our Facebook group. You can do it typically via Twitter or some other means. And specifically, Hunter, how could people follow you or interact with you?
Yeah, I'm on the Facebook group. Sometimes I'll post funny pictures. I contribute to a couple blogs, not related to film at all, but I'll list them just because one of them is on my parents' website. I contribute to their blog. It's called Camino Provisions. It's for helping people travel with travel and gear selection to go hike a pilgrimage in Spain that we've all done. So if you're into traveling, into hiking, check it out. And you know, the blogs apply to more than just this one pilgrimage. And then I also contribute to a blog called Rookie Anglican, rookieanglican.com, that, you know, the three of us here go to an Anglican church. If you want to know more about it and want it in fairly plain language, it's a bunch of classmates from seminary and I got together and we all have tried to make Anglicanism accessible. So those are my two things.
Not that there's any reason it wouldn't be.
Yeah. Yeah.
Cool. So yeah, make sure you're checking that out, especially in the Facebook discussion group. I like to think of Hunter as the Godzilla Beetlejuice. Like if you say Godzilla three times, like Hunter appears. So
October 11th, if anyone is in Greensboro and wants to go see it with me,
you've got a theater reserved, right? Yeah,
I'm going to say that's my goal. So Elijah, same question. How can people continue a discussion with you? Or follow what you do?
Yeah, a couple things. I do work for Church of the Redeemer here in Greensboro, so people can visit our website, redeemergso.org, or email me, Elijah@redeemergso.org. I also just published my first book called Death and Resurrection, Exploring the Mysteries of Suffering and Hope, which is on Amazon right now for $8.99. So trying to keep it affordable. But that's kind of a book about the last 10 years of my life and just some things I've learned along the way, and that I've been blessed to glean from Scripture and the life of Christ in particular. So either one of those are great ways to connect with me, and yeah, I'd love to hear from you if you're interested.
Awesome. And as usual, you can follow me on Twitter @Fizzification. Join our Facebook discussion group. Lots of the people who have been on the show, actually almost everyone who's ever been on the show, for the 109 episodes that we've had now, are in that discussion group. So if there's any episode that you like or want to follow up with or answer questions or talk about Hell or High Water more, which you should if you've seen it, go to our Facebook discussion group and join up. We'll let you in and we can have some great discussions. So do that. As usual, we're so grateful for our excellent guests. So thank you guys. And please, listeners, make sure you're following them on social media or interacting with them. Follow the things they do, buy their books, follow their blogs. They are smart, passionate guys. So thank you also for listening to the show. It always makes me very glad that you've taken time to make this a part of your week. I would ask that you take just a little bit more time, go to iTunes, rate, review the show, 5-star reviews. Let's get a couple more people involved in the conversation. Boost our rankings, let more people find us. That I would be completely grateful. Not that I'm not grateful for you listening in general, but I can't understate how much 5-star reviews with actual written reviews, even if it's just a couple words, helps out the show.
I wrote a 2-paragraph review just yesterday, I think. Just so yesterday, if I can do it, you can do it.
I haven't even checked yet. Because I'm perfectly shameless and reading all reviews or mentioning names. Your review can just be 5 stars. Mention my name on the podcast. You're like that.
This is called the moral dilemma of Mikey's gratefulness.
Yeah, that's right. So, but anyway, like I said, thank you. And until next episode, please remember that story is powerful and entertainment is not mindless. Bye bye.
This podcast has been a Real World Theology production. For more information, check out realworldtheology.com. And thanks for listening.
Now this is podcasting. Woo!
Boom.
Boom.
It is finished.
Boom, boom.
And boom, that boom. Was podcasting.
That was podcasting.